disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest. Do it now.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 bit war, you play Nintendo. On some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't.
Welcome to This Is America, February 9th, 2019. In this episode, we discuss and pull apart the State of the Union speech, looking at Trump's claims regarding how good our economy is doing, his continuing cries for race war and a border wall, his demand for complete impunity, and the meaning of his denouncing of, quote, socialism. But first, a few stories that you may have missed. Thanks to anarchists and anti-fascists in Antifa Seven Hills in the Richmond, Virginia area, a police officer, Robert Stamm, who was recently seen policing protests calling for the resignation of leading Democrats in Virginia in the wake of racist photos coming to light, has been outed as a white nationalist and is currently on leave from the department. As research from Antifa Seven Hills showed, Stamm's social media is filled with references and photos and images of white nationalist and far-right movements, ideas, and groups. And he also stamped his Facebook photos with the logo of the Asatru Folk Assembly, a white nationalist religious grouping. Thanks to initial reporting from Antifa Seven Hills, the story went viral, being picked up across various local TV stations, The Huffington Post, and Heavy.com. In Central California, prisoners say following a hunger strike and the start of negotiations with the warden, talks have unfortunately broken down at Corcoran Prison. As The Intercept wrote, quote, following the hunger strike, the warden allegedly agreed to restore access to the canteen, and prisoners from three units were again receiving packages. A new recreation schedule was said to also be in negotiations, but prisoners claim the canteen continued to provide only hygiene products. They are supposed to meet with Warden Ken Clark on February 5th to continue negotiations, but the warden allegedly delayed the meetings before telling them they would still be forced to share the yard with their political rivals. Prisoners in the 3C unit are supposed to get 10 hours of yard time each week, but advocates say they have only been allowed approximately 1 to 3 hours per week on the yard. Quote, this is if the yard isn't effectively shut down all the time due to the setup fights and jumpings, added Brooke, an IWOC representative. IWOC states that members of the gang are being used against hunger strikers in order to break prison solidarity. This brutal practice has gone on for years as prison officials have often staged bloody gladiator fights. In Oakland, California, teachers once again held a wildcat strike, who were also joined in the streets by students, the vast majority of which did not report to school. Anarchist autonomous groups are mobilizing to provide winter relief in so-called Tacoma, Washington, and Flagstaff. See our show notes for ways to donate and get involved. Amazon officials in New York stated in the Washington Post, which is also owned by Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, that due to continued resistance to proposal to bring the Amazon campus to Queens, New York, they may in fact be pulling out of the city. In Lexington, according to Lexington Anti-Racist Action, quote, protesters shut down Main Street during game day traffic yesterday in front of the Lexington Police Department headquarters over the assault of a 16-year-old black autistic boy by police chaplain Donovan Stewart at Fayette Mall. The street was held for 3 minutes, one of the each time Stewart punched the young boy. Lastly, speaking of class war, according to new government labor statistics released on 2018, quote, in 2018, there were 20 major work stoppages involving 485,000 workers, the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics reported. The number of major work stoppages beginning in 2018 was the highest since 2007, and the number of workers involved in strike activity was the highest since 1986. That's going to do it for us today. Enjoy the conversation. We will see you next time, and here are some upcoming events. On Wednesday, February 13th, the Denver Anarchist Black Cross and a variety of anarchist, radical, and abolitionist groups coming together for a letter-writing party. Check out the information linked in our show notes. On August 3rd and 11th, join the Institute for Advanced Troublemaking in Worcester, Massachusetts for a week-long gathering. Another gathering is happening in so-called Flagstaff, Arizona. From August 16th through the 18th, there's going to be an Indigenous Anarchist Conference. Check out the information linked in our show notes. Thanks a lot for listening, and we will see you soon.
Back on my nothing to lose shit. Back on my fuck you and your crew shit.
Back on my never set foot on a cruise ship. Back on my everyone jumping the bridges. I would not do that shit. Nowhere to run. Only new grounds to fight upon. Nowhere is up. Back in the mud where I belong. Nowhere to run. Only new grounds to fight upon. Nowhere is up. Back in the mud where I belong. Exhibit A is the world, the battlefield to unplanted, gone mad. Until there is each fragment pliable, splitting the thing on its wings. Save this for more, so you can have that ring. I'm gone, blood I've drawn, but not that much. Too many calories burned. No certain metaphor for an economic system, comparing it to Dante's Inferno. Come on, which level of hell is this? They say you shit while you shit, tell you that you ain't shit. Ask your opinion and work around it. These are the songs to sing over smoldering slaughterhouses. This is a song to slap your best self with. Let's be honest, it ain't a song, it's a rant on a beat. Back on my battle rap against oblivion and mundane living. Walking the fine line between self-help and self-destruction. They say abolition's an extremist position, but I can think of nothing more extreme than accepting domination. Trying to sleep while I hear a sirens and people crying, overdoses and neighbors yelling. All this feels normal, but the fish doesn't know that it's water he's breathing. There's nowhere to run, only new grounds to fight upon. Nowhere is up, nowhere is back in the mud where I belong. There's nowhere to run, only new grounds to fight upon. Nowhere is up, nowhere is back in the mud where I belong. They say I'm negative, there's nothing more negative than walking around all day with your head in the sand. I mean the screen, but what is glass for sand made productive? Okay, I'm a negative one. The urge that destroys a creative one. The urge to blend and save that for predators and prey. The look of the day, we make our art under gallows for the people in them and those forced to watch in horror. Fuck am I saying? I don't make art, I make promises. Ill and insurgent, still my own man. Gnawing at the glass to find the unpromised land. Sever that unseen hand. You ask, we seek, you talk, we do the goddamn thing. Back on my exiles, impossible. In an interconnected world, back on my guns, grains and ammo with no delusion. I can go it alone. They build bigger cages, we build bigger tables. They swallow keys, we cut their bellies open. They're overpaid, we're overjoyed. They're on vacation, we're just living. Lucky phone in a Faraday cage all day. If you're a rebel, I know there's nothing I can write that will. In some large way, matter breaks down to atoms. Atoms, we've been living in a nuclear war. War, the day-to-day in our minds and online worlds. Worlds, things to inhabit, not conquer. Nowhere to run, only new grounds to fight upon. Nowhere is up, back in the mud where I belong. Nowhere to run, only new grounds to fight upon. Nowhere is up, back in the mud where I belong.
Okay, we are back once again. Special shout out to a person that just emailed IGD. They had the best troll in the world. They said, oh, how democratic, there's no comments on the website. And I just want to say, I wanted to reply and say, you know, actually, in a way, you're right. Like, if democracy, we define it as kind of this veneer that we have any sort of control other than a passing, you know, comment on, you know, something that really is beyond our control and is already decided upon us. And, you know, the opposite would be that we will actually publish a coherent argument that you have. And you can be part of a larger conversation, but of course you won't do that because you're just a stupid troll that can barely, you know, vomit out a bumper sticker.
Interesting, the most people have never tried to moderate a comment section, which is like 85% spam. So just once ever setting up a website, you'll spend like 75% of your time moderating the comments if you have comments. Just,
oh, of course. There's been a lot that's been going on, obviously. So Trump had a State of the Union speech right off the gate. What are your thoughts?
There were a couple one-liners that were of note. Maybe before diving into those, it's important to kind of like do the step back, 30,000 foot view. Trump promised that this was going to be an earth-shattering speech that was going to fundamentally change everything, and literally nothing interesting was said. It was the State of the Union equivalent of the national address he gave that everyone forgot about like 4 days later. There's nothing new here. He spent about half the speech ranting about the danger of people crossing the border illegally while citing stats about people getting caught for trafficking drugs at port of entry. He made a false claim about El Paso, Texas, having its crime rate dropped to essentially nothing after they built a wall there, which just isn't true. There's a lot of, you know, racist fear-mongering, as one would expect from Donald Trump at this point. And in that way, I mean, what's most interesting is how far we've come as, you know, as a sort of political unit when the President of the United States gets up onto the dais in the House of Representatives and spews a bunch of racist crap, and everyone's like, well, that's about what we expect now. That's pretty just normal at this point. Right. That's how far we've come, is essentially giving a racist propaganda speech from the House of Representatives in the 21st century is considered a somewhat normal thing. I really don't like, in a lot of ways, when people do this repetition of trying to repeat, this isn't normal, this isn't normal, this isn't normal. But what is important sometimes is to sort of follow along what has become normal. Like if we really think, to take a word from the far right, if we really think about, you know, how far the Overton window has been pushed, where Donald Trump can get up and essentially make a racist speech from the House, it's pretty astonishing, actually, if you really think about it. But outside of that, nothing else really happened. He threw out a bunch of kind of decontextualized numbers about the economy and tried to claim credit for them, which is also pretty normal for him. Mm-hmm. The one-liner that I found was absolutely amazing, and this is, if anyone's ever followed Kellyanne Conway and stuff she says, it's totally, absolutely came from her. She loves really bad rhymes. And so Trump said, and I quote, "If there is going to be peace and legislation, there cannot be war and investigation." That is the line of note.
Sounds like a really bad like line from like an early KRS-One song or something.
Right, yeah, it's like the worst mid-90s hip-hop lyric. Right. But so what's notable about that line are two things. One, after he said it, he paused, expecting there to be a rousing round of applause from the Republican caucus, and got nothing. Got total crickets, which I'll kind of circle back to later why that's relevant. But the other thing that he's positing here is that essentially saying if he's able to have free reign to do whatever he wants, right? No political conflict, no oversight of foreign policy, nothing. If he's able to have total free reign, he'll accomplish everything. But given that that's not going to happen, what it seems like he's doing here is starting to build an argument for 2020, where essentially he's going to start saying, you know, this war in Afghanistan that nobody likes, that's going on because the Democrats won't let me end it. You know, this whole, like, me, I'm going to build all this infrastructure and stuff, that's not going to happen because of investigations, right? And what it does is it gives him the ability to make an excuse. Because not only did he promise during the election all kinds of constantly shifting things, right? But he also stated definitively, which was rare for him to state anything definitively, but he also stated definitively that he is this master deal maker who gets things done. And so he needs an excuse as to why literally nothing has happened. He has achieved absolutely nothing that he said he was going to. Literally nothing. And so he's got to have a reason for that. The other thing that's relevant about that is he didn't get the rousing standing ovation he thought he was going to get for that line. And what's relevant about that to me is that what that tells me is that the House Republicans are sitting there and the Senate Republicans are sitting there going, well, if this investigation thing is going to keep going, they can continue to follow along with Trump on legislation, but the investigation is a step too far. And so by them not standing up and applauding the line, what it seems to me that they're signaling is you can't just end the investigations because it's not politically viable. And so if that were to happen, then we're not going to go along with that. And that gives them an out, a way to bail if the investigations get too intense before the next election cycle. They can just bail out and go, we never tried to stop the investigations. That was all him. and that gives him an alibi, essentially, in all of this. So just in that one moment, the signaling that was going on was really fascinating. I mean, there were a lot of other very signaling-centric moments. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez scowling the entire speech, for example, or, like, there's now the memeable Nancy Pelosi clapping at Donald Trump in the most insulting way possible thing. But, yeah, I mean, generally, I mean, the analysis today was pretty blasé because not really much happened. It was a pretty boring speech.
Yeah, I want to touch on a couple of things, but, you know, like you said, I think there's some really important things to highlight here. Again, we heard from Trump that, you know, the economy is doing really well, which, you know, I want to hit on in a bit. But, you know, just how great the economy is. It's all who's doing. Everyone is just a millionaire running around buying whatever they want, and no one has a care in the world. But also there was, of course, you know, the continued fear-mongering, which is the same stuff we've already heard. Trump mentioning that there's another caravan. Actually, I just heard on NPR today that there's people that are starting to trickle in to Tijuana. You know, there's another caravan of a couple thousand people that are coming. I mean, Trump is using essentially the same language he used before. This is happening at a time when the Pentagon has agreed to put more troops on the border to do more of the same stuff, you know, guard the border, put up barbed wire, so on and so forth. And also, like, at the same time as we're in this kind of, like, the box of the conversation is between Trump's wall and the Democrats, you know, supposed, like, counterinsurgency smart wall, which we've talked about a couple weeks ago. So there's that. And then the other interesting thing is that Trump, you know, very somewhat passingly brought up socialism and said that, you know, the U.S. will never be a socialist country and that you know, we're born in freedom and liberty and all this stuff. And I mean, that was essentially it. He said socialism once and socialist again. This comes like a day after there was actually a really interesting a poll that was conducted on Fox News where it stated that even Fox viewers themselves overwhelmingly by more than 50% supported taxing the wealthy, millionaires and over, to fund things, you know, for the country itself. Which kind of threw people on Fox through a loop that, you know, how could their, you know, pro-capitalist viewers somehow support this, you know, very basic socialist initiative that, you know, very wealthy people should pay more money than the rest of us. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, to me, it was kind of a, you know, a shot basically saying, like, look, you know, the elites in this country are going to protect the capital of the elites. It's going to protect private property. You know, this is the system that's in place. That's just how it is. It doesn't matter, you know, what millennials think or, you know, what a couple random progressive Democrats are saying, like, this is how it is. And also it seemed to be kind of, I mean, at least to me, it was pretty much a shot at any sort of, you know, autonomous social movement that's out there saying, like, you know, despite the barbarians at the gates, you know, we're still inside our fortress state, and this is how it is.
Yeah, and I think we have to be careful when we talk about the way that the right wing uses terms like socialism and communism, because they don't know what they mean, right? Or the meaning, what they mean when they say those terms has become so removed from the actual school of political thought, purely through kind of rhetorical citation, right? So since Barry Goldwater, and probably even before that, the right wing has been sort of invoking the specter of socialism and attempting to tie any social movements and anyone that supports any social movements to that label. It was something that came out of the Cold War, but has kind of continued. Now, what's interesting is, and this goes back to Gawker doing polls about this right before they folded, where they were finding the majority of millennials identify as anti-capitalists. Really what they're demonizing when they say things like this is they're demonizing anti-capitalists, but they're also demonizing anybody that's pushing back against anything having to do with the economy. And that's a really important thing to keep in mind, is that whenever they're talking about socialism, they're literally talking about anything that's somehow different than Alan Greenspan-esque, you know, totally deregulated, low interest rate capitalism. Even things like trade tariffs, ironically, in the past, have been considered socialist measures, even though Trump seems to love those, right? Any sort of assistance to keeping factories open was considered a socialist measure. Job programs were considered socialist measures. So, like, the way that they use this is incredibly imprecise. So we have to really focus on the sort of rhetorical intent of why they would be using this term now after so many years of, you know, the far right kind of gave up on the idea as a primary argument that the Democrats are all communists after Obama left office. So there's been like 2 years now where that line has kind of fallen into the background a little bit. So there's a reason why they're bringing this up again. And I think a lot of it has to do with a number of proposals coming from the Democratic caucus that have been, as you were saying earlier, shown to be way more popular than anybody really thought that they would be, right?
Including chief among them, the Big New Deal. The Big New Deal, the Green New Deal.
Yeah, the Green New Deal and progressive taxation, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, you're seeing cities all over the country institute elements of this kind of social democratic program, right? There's a number of major cities in the country that have announced that kids that go to systems will get free college education, right? It's a pretty front and center Bernie Sanders proposal.
Right, and, you know, in the grand scheme of, you know, larger industrial nations that are, you know, quote-unquote democracies, I mean, this is pretty much the standard, you know, this is not kind of like out there politics.
Yeah, and like the means exist to do it if there is a radical redistribution of wealth, right? That's the thing that really is driving this rhetorical push. And you don't just see it from Trump, you also see it from Howard Schultz, the guy who used to run Starbucks, who's now running for president. Mm-hmm. The reason he's been a registered Democrat for a long time, the running for president specifically, and he said this during a book signing in New York a few days ago, essentially he is running for president to stop there from being any redistribution of wealth. And the minute he said, they started getting shouted down from the crowd, which was really interesting, at his own book signing, right?
Right. Well, what do you have to offer then?
What's up?
I mean, like, if you're a Democrat right now and you're like, I'm for any sort of, like, fundamental change in society that's making everything bad, you know, so what are you for then?
Yeah, I think something to keep in mind with the Democrats and why I think Republican strategists and kind of more moderate strategists are starting to see these kinds of things as a possibility is that the Democratic Party for a really long time, and we're talking going back to, you know, prior to Roosevelt, the Democratic Party has thrived on one thing and one thing only, and that is taking all of the moderate elements of every autonomous political initiative and trying to bring them inside of the fold of the Democratic Party.
Sure.
What they'll do is they'll take the most moderate demands, right? The anti-war movement, right? We'll bring you in and we will end the war in Iraq in a, you know, through a kind of slow de-escalation process, blah, 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 blah. That's how people like Kyrsten Sinema ended up in the Democratic Party, right? She was a Green Party candidate in 2003, and now she's a moderate Democrat, right? So they did this with the environmentalist movement too. They took all the demands to fundamentally curb consumption and turn them into, you know, clean coal and emission standards and things like that. And they're doing the same thing with anti-capitalism now. They're taking anti-capitalism, and through the lens of people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, they're turning that into essentially Euro-communism, right? Like market socialism, essentially. They'll preserve the functionality of capitalism, but with taxation rates that will allow for, you know, less stratification of wealth, essentially. Right. And all of this language from the Democrats is about co-opting anti-capitalism, back demonizing the most moderate of anti-capitalism, what you could call anti-capitalism, but they're also, by default, demonizing anything more extreme than that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like Chomsky says with, you know, liberals on TV, it's like the role of them being there is to say, like, look, this is the most extreme thing that could ever be said. So to even conceive of something beyond this is to, like, you know, to lose one's mind. Yeah. And just like you said, I mean, this, you know, it's not anti-capitalism, really. I mean, you know, social democracy is just simply the same thing we have now, except, you know, taking some of these dollars that we put towards the Pentagon and saying, like, hey, let's use a sliver of this towards healthcare, you know. And again, like, these programs already are in existence to a, you know, a very small amount, and they're, and people are saying, look, just expand these, you know, make these more accessible.
And this is what's so dangerous about, there's a tendency now in kind of radical communities to fall into a sort of reactionary politics at this point and sort of cheer on anyone that's not Donald Trump, right? What's so dangerous about that? Because, I mean, this is specifically what the Democrats really hope for. This is what allows them to win elections. Mm-hmm. What's so dangerous about that, though, is that what we're doing is we're allowing the Democrats to become a de-escalatory force, which is largely their kind of political MO, is to take anything that seems interesting and sort of defang it and turn it into something that can exist within the confines of the liberal democratic state. It's not just that. And this is, you know, I've always made this argument that anarchists don't exist on a continuity of Democrats, right? We're not fighting the same fight. When we see Trump say these sorts of things about socialism from the stage, and we see these kinds of levels of support for progressive taxation and people considering that anti-capitalism, we should all be sitting there really asking the question of how do we start to actually combat that strategy, because it is devastatingly effective.
Well, ultimately, all of these things that they're talking about are not solutions to the major crises that we're facing. You know, global warming, you know, thinking of how work will be, like, i.e. the gig economy, automation, AI, machine learning, so on and so forth. You know, and everything else that we're facing right now as well. I mean, yeah. From just the increased cost of living to gentrification, you know, increased stratification, every single facet of our lives to, you know, the social crisis. I mean, all of these things that they're proposing are just bigger and bigger band-aids. And ultimately, I mean, elites have a tendency to always resist the things that would really, in the long run, you know, save the system. I mean, like, you know, that was what the New Deal was about. It was like when FDR finally in 1935 made unions legal, essentially, and created the National Labor Relations Board, that came, you know, several months after the U.S. saw the most days lost because of strikes and also just generalized, literally armed insurrection. I mean, it was, you know, that was the summer after the massive Teamster strike in Minneapolis. Everybody has the poster or on their wall or seen the photos of the Teamsters literally fighting the police in the streets with clubs. I mean, that's why the state did that, was because it could capitulated, but also it knew that by bringing unions into the equation, that it could better control class warfare and move it out of the streets and move it back into the boardrooms. And we've, you know, talked about this before. But, you know, ultimately, too, like when you give people a safety net and they become, you know, and you help them and give them a reason not to riot, ultimately that can be better, you know, as some people within the state would argue, than people literally having nothing to lose.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've gone through this before, like on a purely economic level. For as much as the wealthy aren't going to like it, the idea that they'd get taxed at a higher rate in order to guarantee basic public subsidy for people that aren't wealthy ultimately guarantees a higher consumption index too. It makes capitalism more effective, makes it more efficient. Right. It makes it function in a way that, though not sustainable, at least creates a better image of being sustainable. And it eliminates a lot of the social tension that often comes along with exploitation, right?
Right.
We, in the United States specifically, have a pretty bad track record of doing anything about anything when we feel comfortable. And unlike in a place like France or Italy, where, you know, there are social movements when there's a level of comfort, there's also some when there's not. But in the US, these things tend to arise purely from moments of extreme discomfort. If there's any element of life that can be considered stable, we tend to not see a lot of political unrest. And so these kinds of proposals, for as much as people want to portray them as, you know, radical attempts to defray the worst effects of capitalism, so on, so on, so on, are going to be the thing that ends up saving 21st century capitalism if they're allowed to continue.
Right. Well, speaking of the economy, I just want to really take some time and really hit this, because I think that, you know, for a lot of people, you know, especially if you're at work, you're with people that are older. I think there really is a millennial divide between millennials and older people, maybe even beyond, you know, Gen X. When we talk to people and they talk, they say things, for instance, like the economy's doing really well, or like this politician was great because the economy's doing really great. And especially this happens in a context of talking about life after the economic recession of 2008. And, you know, now that we've had 10 years, we can kind of look back and really see what's happened. And I think it is important to really have at least a basic analysis of what the reality is. So when we're having conversations with people, we can really, you know, push back. Because, you know, to start off, I mean, everybody from Obama to Trump has talked about the economy is doing well. And if you look at the numbers, GDP and all that stuff, it is true that the economy is growing in the sense that, you know, it's making gains. There's a big domestic GDP, gross domestic product. You know, there's more money being made. But the problem is that that actually doesn't mean shit for the rest of us. Right. That wealth, you know, the first point is that wealth is being concentrated in fewer hands. There's a wealth gap in this country, which of course everybody knows about. But beyond that, there's a racial wealth gap. I mean, there's more wealth being concentrated in largely white households when compared to, you know, African-American and brown households. And in fact, African-American families during the Obama administration, you know, during the crisis, and especially during the foreclosure crisis, lost more wealth than they did at any other time since the Great Depression. So there, I mean, there's been a huge stratification that's only increased since the economic crisis of 2018. And I think it's important to really talk about why that is. And largely it's because, as we've talked about on this show many times, you know, the economy has been restructured to the point where most of us and a lot of us are working more and more jobs, more and more hours for less and less pay. And wages, real, what they call real wages, meaning your the amount of money that you're making when compared to inflation and also the cost of living, has in most cases stagnated or in some cases actually gone down. When compared to like the 1970s. So, you know, and you might get this if you talk to your parents, but I mean, compared to the 1970s when your parents were, or if they're, you know, if they're baby boomers or whatever, were first starting out, or maybe they were first starting their, you know, quote, career or whatever, you know, they were making more money than you probably are right now.
Yeah.
And also when you factor in, you know, in today's world, just the fact that a lot of people have massive amounts of debt, whether that's credit card debt or student loans, the fact that most of us are paying upwards of, you know, half of our income on rent, and that, you know, rent continues to go up exponentially, just the cost of living continues to go up, everything from fuel to food, you know, most of us are having to eat out more and more, you know, all of those costs are going up. So as wages have gone down or stagnated, the cost of everything else has gone up. And, you know, more and more of us are not saving for retirement. You know, we don't have any sort of, you know, cushion really when it comes to a future. And that's why more and more people are just, you know, one paycheck away from being totally screwed. You know, there's one statistic out there that a huge amount of Americans like cannot afford like a $400 emergency. So your car breaks down. Or, you know, your check, you know, you don't get paid for a month because the government's on shutdown or whatever. So many people are just right on that line of poverty. And, you know, those realities have only increased, you know, from the economic recession until now. So when Trump talks about unemployment being low, that is true. There are less people per se unemployed than, say, you know, during the Great Depression or something like that. But the reality is that more and more people are working part-time work. They're underemployed. Yes. They're working jobs like in the gig economy, like for Lyft or Uber. And people are trying to kind of like hobble together an existence. And more it's not working. And the thing is that all of these kind of tendencies within the economy that we're seeing, whether it's, you know, precarity, the growth of the service industry as the largest section of the economy, the growth of the gig economy. So basically, you know, your boss is an app, and also just the impacts of automation and AI technology. Forbes, for instance, just came out today that in one article, they argued that in 2019, so this year, 10% of American jobs are going to be lost due to automation.
Yep.
So this is all to say that this basically, this trumpeting of the economy of doing so well, it's like, Yes, it's doing well for some people, but not for the majority of people.
Also, there's very little discussion about what those numbers actually mean, right? So I think one of the numbers that's really important to break down the methodology of is the actual unemployment rate. So there's an assumption that the unemployment rate counts the number of people that are unemployed. But that's not actually what it's doing. That would be an impossible number to aggregate. What the Department of Labor is doing is they actually only aggregate the number of people who are collecting unemployment from the federal government. So say the number of unemployment recipients goes down, even though that is a possibility because you only get unemployment for so long. Things that was actually being seen in the Obama administration was that people were staying on unemployment for so long that the number of people that were falling, quote, out of the workforce, meaning people not collecting unemployment or having a job, was actually outpacing the amount of people losing jobs. And what that did was it created the illusion that the unemployment rate was falling, when in actuality, the unemployment rate was aggregating, where the number of people being unemployed was going up dramatically, but so many people have been unemployed for so long that they fell out of the workforce. So what does that mean now? Well, when we're looking at people who are driving Lyft, driving for Uber, doing DoorDash, like whatever other gig economy thing they're doing, a lot of those people aren't collecting unemployment. Now, they're systemically underemployed, entirely precarious, working for way below in a lot of actual legitimate minimum wage, but they're technically not unemployed because of this 10% of people, 10% of American workers, losing their jobs to automation. One of the things that was really interesting about that article and kind of the secondary literature around that article talking about this. So in the past, people that were losing jobs due to automation were mostly working in manufacturing, right? So they were working in car factories, steel mills, places like that, mines, right? All these things Donald Trump thinks if he just opens up new car plants, people will get jobs again or whatever. All those jobs got automated away a long time ago. What's happening now is that the jobs that are being lost to automation are jobs like taxi drivers, retail store workers, stuff like this, right? Even people who work in fast food. A lot of those jobs are starting to get automated away or disappearing completely.
And you can see this all the time. Like, just in the town I live in, there's a Subway where it basically automates your food order. So it doesn't, you know, there's a job. You know, you walk into Walmart and all of a sudden you see the self-checkout. There's five.
I was just going to say, like, you go to most grocery stores and most big box stores, Target, whatever, the number of automated checkout lanes is going up pretty dramatically. And actually, in a lot of places, the only way that that's not going up is because the union won't let it. So any place that's represented by the UFCW, for example, they tend to put hard limits on the amount of workers that can be essentially made obsolete by automated checkout lanes, right?
So, right. Well, good for them. Yeah, there's also, like, robots in Walmart stocking shelves. Yeah. There's, you know, there's lots and lots of examples of this. It's very small. And what's interesting, too, is, like, for instance, I read a lot of the articles that came out when Walmart first rolled out the robots, and they were like, no, no, calm down. Like, we're not going to take anybody's job. Like, we're just testing this to see if we can, like, use this robot to add on to what's already existing. So, I mean, they were very careful in their language, but, I mean, everybody knows of course they're going to get rid of your job. I mean, why would they pay somebody to do that? And again, like, you know, I brought this up before, but in the Bob Woodward book, Fear, about the Trump administration, you know, there's a moment before Trump comes into office where he's talking with his economic advisors, and they remind him, they said, look, 25% of the American workforce is going to be out of work because their jobs in the U.S., I guess, according to them, 25% of jobs in the U.S. were based around driving. So bus drivers, people delivering beer, so on and so forth. I mean, those it's a funny combination there. But, you know, all of those jobs, you know, are in threat of being automated out. And in fact, they argued that those, you know, that 25% would be automated out in an 8-year period. So if Trump was in office for 2 terms, that by the time he ended, 25% of the workforce, the very blue collar section of it, would be completely automated out of existence by self-driving vehicles.
And these are people who largely had already been left behind by the economic methods that were used after the financial crisis. So these are people that never really saw wage increases, probably saw a significant wage decrease. They're people that often, if they have a college education, aren't using that college education in their job, or don't have access to one at all for various reasons. So these are groups of people that are already economically precarious and were already economically precarious. And now they're becoming even more precarious. What's really interesting to me, though, is that the industries in which those people are becoming obsolete are the same industries that are leading to this sort of growth rate in the GDP, namely retail that has large online components. So Amazon, Walmart, companies like that are doing very well right now because they're cutting their overhead left and right, and they're keeping their prices the same.
And that's exactly what's driving the increase in GDP and the increase in growth in the economy. And I think that's, I mean, that really gets to the heart of it. It's that, I mean, it's that classic, I mean, anybody that sat through high school economics has heard this, but I mean, like, the best way for a business to make more money is to basically cut costs and to pay your workers less and keep doing the exact same thing that you're doing. And that's exactly the corporate model that the U.S. has pioneered. And then you add an automation to it, you know, taking more and more people out of the equation. I mean, that creates more and more.
Well, and getting back to what we were talking about before, right, that is inherent in capitalism. Stratification of wealth is an inherency in capitalist economics. The basic core fundamental problem with that, though, from an economics perspective, is that eventually stratification becomes so severe that it undermines the ability of consumers to consume, which then undermines the ability of the economy to continue to function, right? So the very same outcome or the goal of commodity circulation, which is wealth accumulation, also breeds the conditions of its own collapse. So when we're talking about how do you level set that process again, right? So how do you bring that process back into enough balance to continue to function moment to moment? You have to do things like progressive taxation. You have to redistribute some of that wealth back into the consumer class to continue the economy functioning. If you don't, eventually it all falls apart, right? And so when we're looking at what organizations like the DSA, specifically moderate wings of the DSA, are trying to do with, you know, social democratic proposals, at the end of the day, that is what will save capitalism from itself on the level of pure economics, right? They're not wrong about that. The part that they are wrong about is that that's not going to lead to the, like, socialist utopia world or whatever they're trying to create. It's actually just going to perpetuate capitalism indefinitely, essentially.
Yeah, I just think it's really important that we kind of have this understanding of what's been happening the last 10 years. So when you're sitting at the table and somebody's telling you, you know, the economy's doing great, Trump has, you know, saved us, you know, we can actually say, like, no, actually, things have gotten worse, and they've gotten better for the same people that got bailed out the last time around and the same people that will get bailed out the next time around. Because as we all know, I mean, capitalism is a cycle of boom and bust, and it's going to go up again. And the people that are going to pay the biggest price are, you know, the people that turn the gears, not the people that are making the orders.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, I think the other thing on everybody's minds is there going to be another shutdown? What, we're 2 weeks into this, like, three-week break between decisions? So, I mean, what's on the table right now? Trump has said that he will have another shutdown. You know, he could do a state of emergency. I mean, what is he talking that he will do to get what he wants with the border wall?
So there's a number of possibilities of how this could play out, and I think those possibilities get more and more complex all the time. I know we mentioned four last week when we were talking about this, right? You've got the everybody just gives up and goes home option, which isn't going to happen at this point. Everybody's too deep. You have the Trump caves in on the border wall option, which probably isn't going to happen as well because it's political suicide. You have the national emergency option, which is that Trump declares a national emergency and just uses unspent but already allocated, like generally allocated, not specifically allocated funding. So an example of that would be funding inside the Department of Defense is allocated for construction, but not earmarked for a specific project. That would be money that could be dipped into to be used in the case of a national emergency. So that's an option. The other option is this, like, crazy Lindsey Graham option of, like, attaching border wall funding to the debt ceiling, which seems to have lost steam, which is interesting. But we're really looking at the possibility of another option now, which is something that wasn't really being entertained a week ago, though it was formally possible. And it's one that still there's not a lot of discussion around, but you're hearing rumblings in this direction. And that is that it is very possible that given the way Trump is signaling now, that it is very likely that if February 15th comes and there is no deal that gives him funding for his border wall, that he'll declare a national emergency. And that national emergency will come with caveats. So he'll say, well, I won't spend Department of Defense money to do this, because he knows that there would be political backlash for that. There's been a number of different stipulations that have been thrown out. I know Politico's talked about some of them. No one really knows for sure, but there's a chance that Trump will declare a national emergency on February 15th, and say that that money is going to come from very, very, very specific places and not other places, right? So where he's drawing from becomes kind of conditional. What's really interesting about that scenario is that that's not actually the end of the story here. So there's two other contingencies that could play out after the declaration of a national emergency. The first is, under the National Emergencies Act, Congress does have the ability to declare something the president says is an emergency, not an emergency. What that takes is a resolution passed through both houses of Congress that will then get vetoed by the president, obviously, which then goes back to Congress for the veto override process. So it's conceivable that we could start to watch that process play out. Different people who do vote counting, right? So people who go around and like try and get an idea of what senators want to vote what way on what thing are saying that it's likely that if Trump declares a national emergency, that a bill to invalidate that would pass the Senate and obviously pass the House and get vetoed, but there wouldn't be enough votes to override the veto. So that's one possibility, is we could watch that whole thing play out. The other thing that's also possible, which is not something a lot of people have talked about, the border wall and the shutdown are technically completely different issues. Though they've been brought together rhetorically, in the sense that Trump has said he refuses to sign a budget that doesn't include border wall funding, the reality is that the border wall could be funded and the government could still shut down. Right. So that eventuality looks like two different things that could play out. The first is there is a bill that goes through to fund the border wall separate from the federal budget, which isn't going to happen. There's no political will there. But the other thing that could happen is that Trump could declare a national emergency, and the Democrats' response to that could be shutting down Congress, essentially. And if that happens, the government will still shut down. Just because Trump declares that he's going to build the border wall by fiat, doesn't actually make the 25% of government agencies that are currently funded still be funded after February 15th. And so we could very much watch a scenario in which there is a government shutdown and a national emergency that play out simultaneously. What happens then is anybody's guess, because that's never happened before. So what that looks like is total political gridlock, likely, with the Democrats holding out on everything, including judicial nominees, any other bill, resolutions about foreign policy, congressional resolutions to tell people at a church they did a really good job on their soup kitchen, like literally everything. They could just shut Congress down through the filibuster and refusing to bring things to the floor in the House. At that point, the gambit would be essentially to see how long Trump can last in the national emergency scenario while there's still complete government gridlock, essentially. And I honestly have no idea how that will play out. A lot of that's going to end up becoming a question of who has better messaging and who's able to push it better. If the Democrats are able to push the messaging that what they're doing is they're trying to stop rule by executive fiat, and that the national emergency is a, you know, dangerous move in that direction, they might actually have a chance at winning that fight. And if they win that fight and Trump has to go back on the national emergency, he's done. It's over. Not only is it over for him, but it's over for anybody that supported him in the national emergency. So we'll see. I mean, that That would be an interesting possibility. I don't know how much that's likely, but it has started getting talked about more and more and more starting a couple days ago.
Because a lot of people are saying, like, oh, there's no way he'll do another shutdown. He'd be too unpopular.
Yeah, he doesn't have a choice, though. I mean, at the end of the day, Congress is the one that has the choice here. So even though he's the one that's imposed the conditions that make passing a budget unviable politically, Congress still is responsible for allocating money constitutionally. And so the National Emergency Declaration is an executive action. The budget is a congressional action. And both of those things could wind up in gridlock. So he can say he doesn't want to do another shutdown all he wants. But if he declares a national emergency, there might be one anyways, just because of Democrat attempts to shut down Congress. That's actually increasingly likely if you really read the rhetoric of what's going on coming out of the coming out of Congress right now. Pretty much they've been saying, don't do this because you won't like the consequences. And that's a warning that I very rarely heard from Congress before, where it's not, we're going to tell you what we're going to do if you do this. It's, we're not going to tell you what we're going to do, but it's going to be really bad, so just don't do this. And the only real leverage they have over the national emergency is total congressional gridlock. So that's a possibility, which leads to a really interesting political reality that I don't know if anybody really knows how to analyze at this point, to be honest.
Yeah, because, I mean, once we go back to another shutdown, we're right back where we were. But also, I mean, there's really no clear timeline, I would say, at all.
Yeah. Well, and then there's the other question, which is, say Trump declares a national emergency, the Democrats fund the government without the border wall funding. Well, there's only about $7 billion, depending on your estimate who's doing it, for Trump to draw on for the border wall. The border wall is going to cost, again, depending on who's doing the estimate, somewhere between $30 and $60 billion. So that means he's only a sixth of the way there at the most generous estimate. And so this is going to happen again. The next time budgets come up and he demands border wall funding, well, the same thing's going to happen. So it's really this question of how hard did the Democrats want to play this game right now versus how hard did they want to play the next round? Because they could go super hard right now, you know, completely gridlock Congress and cause a major political crisis and probably come out on top by doing that and destroy the entire administration. But they risk losing that fight too. If they wait till the next time, they have a much better chance of winning. And then the same process just plays out again and again and again and again. What becomes really interesting though is as Trump starts to draw down discretionary government money for the national emergency, that money's not there the next time. And so when Congress passes budgets, they can say pass a budget that says, we're going to give X amount of money to the Department of Defense for construction on the condition that none of it is used in a national emergency context or none of it's used to build this specific project or whatever. They can put conditions on that cash. And so it's possible Trump gets his money this time. And then that is the last thing he is able to accomplish. Because once that happens, if he declares this national emergency, it will be congressional gridlock to one degree or another for the rest of his administration. There's literally no way around that. So he's toying with the nuclear option here. And if he takes it, all political norms that we had in the United States going into this year, a lot of them are superseded at that point, depending on how people react. And we're entering a different political reality if that were to happen.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.